Over the long sweep of history, human collectivities have configured themselves in many ways, successively taking up and casting off a vast variety of ways of life, cultural practices, political and economic systems, and much more besides. We have tried on authority-driven, pre-scientific cultures, and then cast them off for cultures rooted for cultures more committed to scientific rationality. We've constructed cultures around identities rooted in the primacy of kin, clan, or tribe. But we have also haltingly embraced cultures devoted to more cosmopolitan ideals. Now, my aim in this essay is to reflect on the structure and dynamics of this sprawling, variegated, ever-evolving landscape, and to ask whether and to what extent it can be rightly viewed as the work product of human reason. My approach draws initial inspiration from Aristotle, who defined humankind as the rational animal. Aristotle was, I think, right on two fronts. Reason is a distinctively human capacity, and we humans are mere animals. I propose to take this Aristotelian insight utterly seriously, and I will argue that the animality of human reason sits uneasily with a broadly rationalist conception of reason's nature and destiny, particularly of its role in shaping the dynamics and topology of the cultural landscape. A broadly rationalist conception of reason would have it that when reason is properly deployed, it is intrinsically fit to direct us toward the true and the good. The rationalist can, of course, allow that specifying just what the proper deployment of reason consists in is no mean or simple task. She can also allow that reason sometimes finds itself hostage to the winds of mere fortune, especially when evidence, time, and resources are limited. And even when the winds of fortune do not turn reason away from the path of the true and the good, she will say, we may fail of our own accord to deploy reason rightly. We are, after all, finite, fallible creatures, and there is no guarantee that reason will always be in full control of the gears of the human mind. So even one who regards reason as our one sure guide to the true and the good can allow that we are sometimes moved not by the force of the better reason, but by various forces of unreason, distorting passion, motivated or self-deceptive thinking, superstition, prejudices, and biases of a vast variety. And when the gears of the mind are moved by such dark forces, we are liable to all manner of illusions and errors. Now, this catalog of the vulnerabilities of our minds to the forces of unreason allows even the rationalist to grant that belief in the true and pursuit of the good are not always and already achieved, rational animals though we may be. Indeed, she will insist that many of the archaic cultures of the past were founded on just such errors and illusions. Still, despite acknowledging our vulnerabilities, the rationalist will insist that we must not underestimate reason. We must not allow the fact that the force of the better reason is sometimes blunted within or is tripped up by ill fortune to blind us to reason's true nature. Properly deployed, in favorable circumstances, the true intrinsic destiny of reason remains to direct us toward the belief in the true and pursuit of the good. Indeed, from this perspective, the fact that the cultural landscape is littered here and there with the detritus of error and illusion is but a testament to the long-run triumph of reason over unreason, since reason, on this view, will eventually sweep all the detritus left by unreason away. Now, I aim to contest this optimistic assessment of the role of reason in sculpting the topology and dynamics of the cultural landscape. I will offer a competing picture of reason and its powers, though I do not claim to settle the contest, the competition here. Indeed, exactly what I do hope to achieve in these pages depends on where you begin. If you are a neutral agnostic, my goal is to tilt the balance of the competing considerations just enough to convince you that there is more to be said against and less to be said for the broadly rationalist picture than you might have antecedently imagined. If you are a committed fellow traveler, and I hope a few of you are, I hope to bolster your positive convictions and to arm you with what I flatter myself may be new arguments for our side. Finally, if you are a rationalist, I hold out little hope of persuading you. But, I do hope to awaken you from your dogmatic slumber, to sound an alarm, and to alert you that the contest is still on. I aim to undermine the optimistic assessment of the intrinsic power and ultimate destiny of reason, and to replace it with a more sobering assessment. But I do not come to blame reason. Neither do I come to praise it. My attitude is one of detached equanimity. This is the sort of attitude that might befit a naturalistic Martian anthropologist, philosophical anthropologist, sent to planet Earth to observe and to explain these merely human creatures. In that guise, we may imagine ourselves, and this is important, we may imagine ourselves armed with something like total natural science, from fundamental physics through evolutionary biology and a completed cognitive science. We will also deploy the descriptive and explanatory resources of dynamic systems theory. Using these tools, we seek to survey and to chart the spatially sprawling, temporally extended, ever-evolving human cultural landscape. Now, it is important that from our detached anthropological perch, we will be casting no normative assessments upon the various local configurations through which we observe human reason and culture to walk. Our explanatory aim is to chart these configurations in both their synchronic and diachronic relations one to another and to the sprawling landscape considered in its totality, but without endorsing any normative or justificatory story about its dynamic unfolding. Now, though we come merely to observe and to explain, nothing prevents us from acknowledging that reason is a powerful instrument, mere animal capacity though it may be. Reason clearly grounds much that is distinctively human, from our distinctive forms of social, political, and moral life to our impressive cognitive achievements in science, mathematics, and especially philosophy. But the achievements of reason, we observe, have not come in a relentless forward march. Our actual historical walk through the space of possible configurations of reason and culture has, on my view, involved much blind stumbling about, often into cul-de-sacs of error and illusion. Now, it is also true that reason's blind stumbling has sometimes been leavened by strokes of good fortune, and I do not deny that these strokes of good fortune have often been consolidated into a greater hold on both the true and the good. But the point is that from our normatively detached perspective, both the blind stumbling and the opportunistic consolidations should be taken to have full and equal claim to being the work of reason. If so, then the rational landscape is revealed as one populated not only by monuments to the success of reason, but also by relics of its failure. Now, to carry out our cartographic mission, we need some measuring tools. The first is a notion of a dialectical cohorts. Those are pictures of dialectical cohorts up there. A dialectical cohort is a human collectivity localized over some region of post-evolutionary time and cultural space, such that the members of that cohort are rationally interanimating in the sense that they share certain modes of reasoning, with these modes of reasoning functioning to sustain the cohort as a cohort. X and Y count as members of the same cohort if X has the capacity to engage Y by modes of reasoning that move Y in ways that also move X. Y has the same capacity with respect to X, and X and Y mutually endorse, at least tacitly, the modes of reasoning as authoritative. I won't really say what authoritative means. I have a long story about that, but I can't tell it here. Distinct dialectical cohorts may be knitted together as cohorts by distinct modes of reasoning. Forms of reasoning that knit together pre-scientific, pre-literate, or pre-philosophical cohorts may differ from forms of reasoning that knit together more advanced or refined cohorts. Within a single cohort, intellectual progress, so-called, may give rise to new or refined forms of reasoning. When changes of this sort happen, a new form of reasoning may come to play the knitting together role. When the members of a cohort jointly evolve such new forms of reasoning, it may move as a cohesive cultural unit through configuration space. But dialectical cohorts may also fragment and divide. Some, but not others in the given cohort, may take up the new forms. Once tightly knit cohorts may fragment into reactionary and progressive sub-cohorts who no longer enjoy a meeting of the dialectical ways. Out of such partings of the dialectical ways, new arrays of dialectical cohorts may constitute themselves. Although dialectical cohorts tend to be collectivities, at the very extreme, a single subject may form a cohort of one. A single subject may even count simultaneously as members of multiple dialectical cohorts, with each sustained by a different mode of reasoning. Because of the multiplicity of the ways in which dialectical cohorts may be constituted, we, in our detached equanimity, must be prepared to find that the internal normative lights of reason may be distributed and diverse. That's the main theme of this, that reason has distributed and diverse normative lights. And much of what I say follows from that. Our initial characterization of dialectical cohorts has been from a high perch. Zooming closer in, one cohort can be distinguished from another by what I call their internal normative fine structures. The normative fine structure of a cohort will be determined by a lot of different things. Here's a list, partial. A set of background theories, epistemic principles, rules of inference, practical cognitive dispositions, values, and so on, by which the cognition and conation of its inhabitants are normatively regulated. Normative fine structures generate reasons and mediate the propagation of warrant both within individual agents and from agent to agent. That's representing the role of a normative fine structure in propagating warrant from one agent to another. My beliefs are rational, I testify to you, you come to believe something on the basis of well-founded reasons. Normative fine structure will determine which beliefs count as reasonable given what evidence, which further beliefs are rationalized by which initial beliefs, which plans or intentions are supported by which values and commitments, and which courses of action it is reasonable to pursue given which plans or intentions. Shared normative fine structures subserve the transmission of reason from agent to agent. They thus undergird and sustain various forms of interagential engagement. They thereby play shared normative fine structures, thereby play essential roles in knitting human collectivities together into what I call rational or normative communities, communities in which the rational powers of one may become rational resources for all. Now, when I say that normative fine structure generates reasons and propagates warrant, I do not intend to refer to so-called external reasons or objective warrant. In fact, I think you can tell from the tone of my voice, I doubt that coherent metaphysical sense can ultimately be made of these notions, despite prodigious efforts by various people. At least not to the extent that standing as an external reason is thought to be determined somehow independently of facts about internal normative fine structure. Nor do I intend to refer to warrant or reasons as measured by our own detached Martian normative lights. Remember, we're casting no normative lights on the human rational landscape. What we seek to investigate are the normative illuminations cast in various directions by the native inhabitants of the human rational landscape in all their manifold relations one to another, to the extent that they are ratified or resisted by the members of this or that cohort. So the cohort over here casting illuminations that way, a cohort over here casting illuminations that way, and sometimes they say to each other, the hell? I'm like, no. Right, we'll get to that. So the sort of reasons and warrant, the generation and propagation of which we are attempting to understand, are thus purely internal reasons and purely internal warrant. Elsewhere in this big book that Quan Loi mentioned, I will say a great deal more about normative fine structures, including their psychological and social roles, their metaphysical natures, their normative significance, and their roles in both individual and collective self-configuration and self-governance. I will not attempt to recapitulate the details of that much larger story here, but a brief example, an illustrative example, should suffice to convey a rough feel for the kind of thing I have in mind. Consider the attitude of valuing. Valuing, I claim, is a distinctive psychofunctional state of the human mind. It's a state which plays both a central causal functional role in a normal human psychology, but also a central normative role in the generation of reasons. Suppose I value the well-being of my child. That's me valuing my child there. Suppose I value the well-being of my child. I am thereby causally disposed to behave toward my child in certain ways. But I also have protanto reason to perform the very actions that my valuing causally disposes me to perform. Absent my valuing, I might lack both motivation and reason to behave in that very way. Notice I said that I might lack, not that I would lack. That's because normative fine structures are complicated, multifaceted things that generate reasons in any number of ways. And other elements of my normative fine structure might generate reasons for me to behave in the relevant way, even if I did not value my child. The crucial point, though, is that valuing enjoys a distinctive sort of normative power. It is one thing for it to be true, for example, that doing such and such would promote the well-being of my child. It is another thing entirely for that consideration to amount to a reason for me to do such and such. It is my valuing that takes the otherwise normatively mute consideration, takes a consideration, and yields a reason. That's what that slide illustrates. Now, the reasons that are generated from this or that combination of a consideration and a value may vary in weight. Weight will often depend on the location and role of the relevant value in an overall normative-defined structure. For example, some of an agent's values may be bound up with what I call ground-level identity-constituting projects. Through ground-level identity-constituting projects, an agent undertakes to make herself into a determinate being in the human world with a thick identity, partly defined by a network of commitments, attachments, and values. When values are bound up with such ground-level projects, they tend to generate reasons of a very weighty kind, what I call reasons that are experienced as coterminous with the self. Reasons experienced as coterminous with the self. A reason is experienced as coterminous with the self for an agent if her failure to act on it would be tantamount to a form of self-alienation. Now, if there are such reasons, they are very weighty. They are very weighty reasons indeed. But this is not the place to settle how weighty they really are. I'm not prepared to say at the moment whether such reasons do or do not, for example, trump all other reasons or certain other reasons. Perhaps, specifically moral reasons, if there are any such things, play such a foundational role in the configuration of any permissible, rational self that they manage to override reasons that might otherwise be experienced by an agent as coterminous with herself. Though I don't profess to understand him fully, I think maybe Kant thought something like this. Perhaps Kant would have said that the problem with Hitler was that he did not possess a rationally permissible self. That the self that he, either he had no self, or the self that he possessed was not rationally permissible, so that he had a duty of self-alienation. I doubt that this Kantian intuition can be sustained, but I'm not going to stop to argue about that here, although I do in this big book. But if moral reasons, a conditional is true, if moral reasons do override reasons that would otherwise be experienced as coterminous with the self, they're very weighty reasons, since they are plausibly then capable of requiring even self-alienation of us. It is fair to wonder how it is fair to wonder from where in the natural order of things, you might think, well, they don't come from the natural order, but I'm a naturalist, so. It is fair to wonder from where in the natural order of things reason so conceived could possibly come from, and how they could possibly get their commanding hold on us, especially how they could be addressed to us as creatures with selves. Now, not all elements of a normative-defined structure need to generate weighty reasons. Not all values, for instance, are tied up with things fundamental. Some things that one values only lightly. Suppose that one values one's comfort and ease. That may give one pro-tanto reason to take various actions to secure comfort and ease. But valuing comfort and ease does not mean that there are no things, persons, or causes that one values more. Precisely when one values comfort and ease only lightly, it can be the case that when the chips are down and things of greater consequence are at stake, one will have countervailing reasons of significantly greater weight to sacrifice one's comfort and ease. Now, I have said little about the million-dollar question for an approach like this. Where do reasons come from? Where do values come from? And I've only hinted at the full story of whence they achieve their reason-giving force. I lack the space to do adequate justice to such questions here. But I will note, and this is just a passing note, I will note that it is crucial to my view of such matters that human normative fine structure, including the psychic capacity to value, is built into the evolved architecture of the human mind-brain. It is because of that evolved architecture, because we are the rational animal, that we humans are what I call norm and value-mongering creatures. We value and monger, we monger norms the way a cheesemonger mongers cheese. Find an animal that mongers after no norms, that values nothing, that altogether lacks any psychic normative fine structure, and that animal will not, I submit, be recognizably human. That is why Aristotle was precisely right to call humankind the rational animal. Now, although we are evolved to monger norms and values, we do not, I think, find or discover the values that we monger as if they were always and already present in the universe, independently of anything that we do or are. Independently of the existence within it of value-mongering creatures like ourselves, the world is laden with fact, but not yet with value. If we are to successfully monger after value in a value-free world, one laden with nothing but fact, we must somehow manage to create the values that we monger. This we do, I suggest, simply by engaging in the merely human, entirely natural animal activity of valuing things. In valuing things, we take things to matter. In taking things to matter, we make them matter. We make them really and truly matter, at least to ourselves. And if this is right, human valuing may be thought to both precede and explain the having of value. Now, to say that our valuing precedes and explains having value is not quite to say that we create value ex nihilo. Even in a world laden with nothing but fact, valuing can still be understood and ought to be understood as a kind of responsiveness to the world. That's because a world not laden with value may still afford, in virtue of its fact-laden nature, value-mongering creatures opportunities to exercise their capacity to value. Now, a value affordance differs from an antecedently existing value in something like the way an invitation differs from a command. Antecedently existing values, if there were such things, might be thought to command the rational will. Affordances exercise no such power. They invite rather than command. Now, when an agent responds to such an invitation by in fact valuing what she has been invited to value, it comes to occupy a place in her normative fine structure. She thereby promotes it through her valuing into a source of reasons. Now, partly because of the way the world is, and partly and more importantly, because of the way that we are, the world is present to us as teeming with the affordance of value. Because of our evolved nature as value-mongering creatures, we come to the world antecedently poised to exploit such affordances, such value affordances, as the world offers up. Now, to appreciate the relative contribution of our own nature and the nature of the world to the generation of value, consider a dog and its owner out for a walk on a hot summer day. They come across a tree. The two animals are antecedently poised to engage with the tree in two quite different ways. Consequently, the tree may afford the dog the opportunity to mark territory, while it affords the man the opportunity to escape the sun's rays. And here's the point. Independently of the existence of animals poised to engage with it in certain ways, it would be a mistake to conclude that the tree is intrinsically laden with value. There would be neither theoretical nor practical utility in concluding that the tree is either intrinsically valuable for territory marking or intrinsically valuable as a provider of shade. For creatures like ourselves, for animals like ourselves, navigating a world that affords boundless opportunities to value is among our most urgent tasks, both as individuals and as collectivities. It is a task that we have no realistic possibility of forswearing, at least so long as we are destined to live lives that are recognizably human. to forswear the task of a world laden with nothing but fact, but teeming in its presentation to us with the affordance of value, would be to abandon the very project of constituting ourselves as human beings in a human world. In taking up or refusing the world's many invitations to value, we not only configure our identities as human individuals among other human individuals, we also array ourselves collectively into normative communities. This, I submit, is part of the work that reason, in its distributed and divided way, has shouldered with varying degrees of success and failure in its relentless sculpting of the rational landscape. Now, just because value affordances invite rather than command, it is hardly surprising that both individuals and cohorts may take up or refuse different total packages of such affordances. Different total packages of values and norms are markers of the different ways in which reason has configured itself locally. What we seek to know from our detached anthropological perch is not who has the normatively right or best total packages, but how radically, along what dimension, for what reason, and with what normative consequences, cohorts may differ from one another in the total packages they take on. Now, settling these matters is beyond the scope of this essay, but it is worth decisively settling. But it is worth noting various possible ultimate outcomes of this kind of inquiry. On the one hand, we may discover that there are a set of universal constraints that all humanly possible normative fine structures must satisfy, in much the way that linguists who believe in the universal grammar suppose that there is a set of universal constraints that all humanly possible languages must satisfy. Universal constraints on humanly possible normative fine structures, if they exist, may provide a degree of scaffolding, thick or thin, within which some degree of variance in fine structure is still possible. The thinner the scaffolding, the more possible normative fine structures may vary. The thicker the scaffolding, the less they may do so. If there are such constraints, we ultimately need to determine where they come from. They're perhaps most likely to be built into the fundamental architecture of the mind, presumably by natural selection. But that's an empirical hypothesis. Now, our detached equanimity positions us to chart the landscape from what I call a decentered, nonpartisan vantage point, without making antecedent assumptions about which of the extant fine structures deserves to be privileged over others. That's our position. But we cannot expect the same detachment of the native inhabitants of the landscape themselves. That's because the members of any given dialectical cohort are unlikely to construe alternative configurations of reason as normatively on a par with their own. They are likely to illuminate the entire history and dynamics of reason from their own perspective, via their own partisan normative lights, as if they themselves occupied the center of that landscape. Now, when illuminated in a one-sided way by the centered and partisan normative lights of this or that cohort, some of the many alternative local configurations of reason will be present to the members of the illuminating cohort as exemplars of cognitive or moral virtue, while others will be present as exemplars of cognitive or moral vice. Moreover, what one cohort construes as cognitive or moral virtue, others may construe as cognitive or moral vice. From our perspective of detached, decentered equanimity, the various normative illuminations cast this way and that by the many native dialectical cohorts are just further facts on the ground. We take those illuminations as further features of the sprawling landscape, the dynamics and topology of which we seek to chart and explain. Now, at the start of our inquiries, We bestow no antecedent privilege on any one of the native cohorts or on their normative illuminations of the landscape. But over the course of our inquiries, we do seek to discover which, if any, location in the landscape, which, if any, locations in the landscape represent stable equilibria in configuration space, and which, if any, enjoy large basins of attraction. For example, we may eventually discover that however political structures start out initially arrayed, they are subject to relentless pressure across all possible fine structures to evolve over time toward more democratic and egalitarian forms of life. If that were right, democratic and egalitarian forms would then be revealed as dynamically favored, and they would be shown to enjoy large basins of attraction. There might be other configurations that are hard to evolve, and where they do evolve are almost invariably thrown off, so they're unstable. Now, we hope and expect to discover a plethora of such regularities about the rational landscape. But caution will be required, extreme caution will be required in interpreting such discovery, since there is no guarantee that dynamically favored configurations are ipso facto more rational than less dynamically favored ones. To reach that conclusion, we would need to know a great deal more than the mere fact that they are somehow dynamically favored. We would need to know, for example, the extent to which the evolution of the landscape over time is governed by the free operation of reason alone, rather than at least partly by extra-rational factors like power or chance. Though we refrain from prejudging such questions, it is important that we need not forswear, and this bears stressing, we need not forswear the very attempt to determine where the free operation of reason begins and ends. If reason is a distinctive causal power in nature, as we take it to be, it must be distinguishable from other natural powers. Now, there are several potential sources of insight available to us in our attempt to demarcate reason, considered as a natural power, from other natural powers. Arguably, the more grounds that we have for concluding that the settling of the rational landscape into a given equilibrium point is path independent, the more likely it will be that it represents a point of rational convergence, such that rational cognizers and actors, just to the extent that they are driven by reason, independently of these various extra-rational forces, will, in the fullness of time, settle on that equilibrium point, however radically their precise trajectory through configuration space may differ from one another. But whether there are one, many, or no such points of rational convergence is an issue that cannot be settled a priori or in advance. In addition to charting the internal contours of the rational landscape, we also seek to locate its outer boundaries. These are folks at the outer boundaries, possibly. This require that we have, that's a madhouse. That's an old photo of an insane asylum, and that's some gorillas or chimps or something. This requires that we eventually distinguish at one extreme where reason shades off into what I call remnants of reason, where these may be characteristic of certain broken brains and dysfunctional minds. Here, an important clue that we may have reached the boundary may come from isolated cohorts, perhaps spatially embedded in larger communities, but with limited access to the means of more thoroughgoing dialectical engagement with those larger communities. As always, caution, extreme caution, is required. For lack of dialectical engagement may simply be a marker of the inaccessibility of one point in configuration space from some other point in configuration space, rather than a sign that we have actually reached the landscape's boundary. At the other extreme, we need to distinguish mere precursors of reason, of the sort that might be characteristic of certain not yet rational animals, from reason fully formed. Here too, caution is required. For the boundary between reason and its precursors may be vague, indeterminate, and shifty. They may also be sharp, well-defined, and fixed. We cannot say in advance. A further and deep challenge is to determine the extent of reason's fragmentation or unity. The fact that native inhabitants of the landscape may be arrayed in many and diverse dialectical cohorts with many different normative fine structures already suggests at least some degree of fragmentation. But we must not draw any premature conclusions until we have more fully charted the overall landscape and, something I don't do in this paper, but I do in the big book, and have plumbed the deep psychology of reason. Perhaps a few large attractors dominate the landscape. Perhaps many and diverse attractors compete for local dominance of this or that subregion of rational space. The fewer attractors, the less fragmented we may take reason to be. The more attractors, the more fragmented it may be. The deep psychology of our rational powers may also provide important clues. If our rational powers are ultimately grounded in a unified psychic capacity that enables reason to function in the manner of, say, a Cartesian universal instrument, we might expect less fragmentation. But if our rational powers, are realized in a motley collection of disunited modules with no deep underlying unity, as some evolutionary psychologists have argued, then we may find greater fragmentation. Now, human reason is a self-narrating faculty. These people are responding to a speech by George Bush with various praise or denunciation or, right? They all have a different take. Now, human reason is a self-narrating faculty. And if we are to understand reason's true nature, we must understand the way in which it narrates its own history and dynamics. Reason is also a distributed faculty, that which occupies a plenum of distinct locations in configuration space. Hence, if we are to understand the way in which reason narrates itself, we must explore the various ways in which dialectical cohorts represent one another to themselves. This will provide the essential clue to reason's distributed self-understanding. We suppose that each native cohort has an internal, centered, at least partial map of the landscape of reason. To say that a cohort's map is centered is to say that it privileges its own location in configuration space as a sort of rational downtown. By means of such a map, a cohort will locate other cohorts at varying rational distances from itself, considered as a center. Partiality, I said they're centered, partisan, and partial, at least potentially partial. Partiality reflects the possibility that not all locations in configuration space will necessarily be accessible from every other location in configuration space. Now, when one cohort represents another as nearby itself in configuration space, the members of the two cohorts will tend to enjoy a high degree of what I call rational solidarity, especially if that representation of rational proximity is mutual. I represent you as nearby, you represent me as nearby. We know how to reason together. Subjects who are in full rational solidarity participate in a community of reasons grounded in a system of mutually conferred, mutually endorsed normative statuses. There may still be disagreements where there is full solidarity, but those disagreements are likely to be mutually understood as reasonable disagreements, to be reasonably settled by shared methods for settling disagreement. So closest in are those with whom we're in rational solidarity. Separated by greater distance in rational space will be subjects who are represented as still reasoning but unreasonable. In the still reasoning but unreasonable others, subjects may recognize clear traces and signs of reason at work, but that recognition will not take place against the backdrop of fully shared normative fine structure. In the unreasonable but still reasoning other, we may recognize that there is still reasoning, still believing, still valuing, still the conferral of normative status, but we may regard the reasoning as less than fully comprehensible, the values as alien, and the normative statuses as lacking in authority. Now, from our own dissentered and detached perch of normative equanimity, relations among cohorts that take one another to be still reasoning but unreasonable is a matter of urgent theoretical interest. For such relations will play a significant role in our attempt to understand the extent to which reason in its distributed multiplicity is or is not divided from itself. Finally, at a greater rational distance still, will be subjects who take the other not to be not merely unreasonable, but entirely irrational. When one takes another to be irrational, one may doubt that one firmly recognizes reason at work in the other at all. One does not necessarily locate the other entirely outside the landscape of reason, though one may be more likely to do so where a cohort is small, dialectically isolated, and manifestly incapable of more thoroughgoing engagement with other cohorts. It is in such cohorts that the remnants of reason, as I call them, may tend to reside. Now, because we seek to chart both the internal contours and the outer boundaries of the ever-unfolding rational landscape from a normatively detached vantage point, we are not entitled to arbitrarily center our map on this or that configuration in configuration space. But since we also seek to understand reason's distributed and diverse self-representation, we cannot ignore the role of self-centering in shaping the topology and dynamics of the landscape. Our own map, therefore, must be a non-centered map of centered maps. We must map in a non-centered way the collectivity, the totality of centered maps. That is, we must chart not just the variety of locations in the rational landscape in their dynamic and topological relations one to another. We must also chart what I call the vectors of normative illumination cast toward and from each location in configuration space from other locations in configuration space. And this raises a far-reaching question. What are we to say when our non-centered map conflicts with one or more of the centered maps deployed by some native inhabitants? Suppose that the members of a given dialectical cohort fail to represent a possible configuration of reason, fail to represent as a possible configuration of reason what we, from our detached perspective, take to be just one more among reason's many local configurations. On what grounds do we disagree and declare that what the native inhabitants take to be unreason, or the still reasoning but unreasonable other, is but one further location in configuration space, possibly with equal claim to being a configuration of reason as their own? Our answer turns on the distinction between thick versus thin conceptions of reason. We, in our detached equanimity, construe reason in a maximally thin and therefore maximally encompassing way. Deploying a thin conception of reason positions us to be able to discern what is variable and what is fixed in the possible normative fine structures into which reason configures itself locally. On a thin conception of reason, we will find reason wherever we find agents with the power to confer normative status and the power to reflectively guide and govern their cognitive and conative lives, both collectively and individually, in accordance with such conferred statuses. Even where two dialectical cohorts differ significantly in their values, theories, epistemic practices, practical proclivities, political outlooks, or moral sensibilities, we are prepared to allow that though they, that though they may indeed occupy distinct locations in configuration space, they nonetheless count equally as configurations of reason. We do not presume to be able to say from the start which among the many different normative fine structures is more pleasing or more abhorrent to reason as such. Of course, native cohorts are not subject to this same thinness constraint. Indeed, we have already implied that native cohorts will typically deploy thicker, less inclusive conceptions that privilege their own normative fine structure as a rational downtown. Though we do not purport to pronounce on what is more pleasing or born to reason as such, even from our detached perspective, we are free to take note that in centering their maps on their own location, native cohorts may mistakenly represent that which is characteristic only of their own normative fine structure as fixed requirements of reason. They may also mistakenly locate the alien rational other, as I call it, at or beyond the outer boundary of the landscape. By positioning ourselves to correct partisan-centered maps in this way, we do not mean to rule out, however, the very possibility that some partisan-centered maps or other may be revealed over the course of our inquiries as in fact the one true map of the landscape, perhaps correctly centered on its true downtown. Indeed, we can even allow the possibility that some dialectical cohort or other may already deploy a thin, maximally encompassing, decentered map of the sort we're trying to construct. But neither of these outcomes seems antecedently likely, certainly not mandatory. Nothing could privilege an arbitrary point in configuration space as the downtown of the rational landscape independently of its dynamical role in the landscape's overall temporal unfolding. To earn standing as the one true downtown, a normative fine structure would have to occupy a privileged dynamical role, perhaps as the single point of convergence toward which all configurations gradually evolve, though even this is not likely to suffice, for it would also need to have what I call a privileged vector of illumination that correctly represents all remaining configurations in their true dynamic and topological relations to this one true downtown. It would be a surprising fact, in need of explanation, if the centered map of some arbitrary cohort turned out to have such properties. Now, the vector of illumination of any given of a partisan map, excuse me, now the vector of illumination of a partisan map of any given dialectical cohort may itself evolve as the cohort gains increased understanding of the true dynamics and topology of the landscape and a better appreciation of their own place within it. Such evolution may perhaps be the long-run result of repeated encounters among cohorts with different normative fine structures. Through such encounters, cloistered cohorts with constricted visions of the space of rational possibilities may come to more fully appreciate that perhaps even those with starkly alien forms of life are still fully and equally rational. When the dogmatic religious zealot, armed with what she regards as rationally unassailable beliefs, confronts the skeptical secular humanist who claims for her side the backing of reason to reject the dogmatist's most deeply held belief. Or when the ardent defender of traditional values and mores, who sees these as a bulwark erected by reason itself as a defense against unreason, is brought short by the determined rejection of the transgressive other who disdains rather than respects her hallowed tradition and rather sees herself as the leading edge of reason's future. Or when the marauding cosmopolitan, traveling under the flag of a dehistoricized, delocalized conception of the rational, is made but the unwelcome and despised stranger in locality stubbornly but happily mired in outmoded local ways. It is not entirely inconceivable that each will gain greater imaginative acquaintance with the realm of the rationally permissible. If so, such encounters may lead to increased, if begrudging, tolerance, perhaps even to an expansion of solidarity and more thoroughgoing rational community. Expanding solidarity might go hand in hand with the thinning out of thick conceptions of reason and the decentering of partisan maps. Given enough such encounters, perhaps there would be some degree of convergence over time in the parsing of normative fine structures into elements that count as fixed requirements of reason and elements that may vary without loss of rationality. Yet even a cursory perusal of human history tends to give the lie to such expectations. The thinning out of thick conceptions and the decentering of partisan maps are far from being the inevitable outcomes of alien encounters. Especially when asymmetries of power are involved, such encounters often result not in greater tolerance or deepening solidarity, but in the brute domination of one over the other, perhaps even in the permanent silencing of one of reason's many voices. The thought that reason might be so divided against itself that in its free, unfettered operation, it still may configure itself into cohorts of dominator and dominated will no doubt seem bracing. And one may seek refuge from this bracing thought in a kind of dismissal. One may reason that such configurations could be normatively grounded in nothing but the dominator's self-generated entitlement to power and privilege. But where the will of the dominated is not entirely extinguished, the self-generated entitlement of the dominator will be forever unratified and resisted by the dominated rational other. Not entirely without reason might one be tempted to dismiss such configurations as rare, unstable, even unjustifiable. But from our perch of detached equanimity, we are not entitled to this refuge of dismissal. It is not just that we cannot say in advance of the unfolding of the landscape whether configurations involving a dominator and a dominated are either rare or unstable. We can, but it's not just that. It is also that we are not entitled to pronounce on which configurations are justified and which are not. That's the business of the native inhabitants. This last point bears emphasis, especially if we are tempted to take refuge from the bracing thought in a kind of denial. By the denial, I mean this. Dominators may have their motivating reasons, it may be said, but they will never have the weight of normative reasons on their side. But the refuge of denial is no more open to us than that of dismissal. Everywhere we look in the unfolding rational landscape, we observe competing reasons being proffered up by native inhabitants one to another. These proffered up reasons are always contestable and often contested. And both within and between native dialectical cohorts, we find proffered reasons which are ratified by some and resisted by others. From our lofty perch, we have no part in settling such contests. That is rather a messy retail business, properly belonging only to the native inhabitants of the landscape themselves. No doubt, this always and everywhere unfolding retail dialectic of ratification and resistance plays an inimitable role in shaping the rational landscape, the dynamics and topology of which we seek to chart. We must therefore closely attend to all such contests of reasons. But we are in no position to declare victory for one side or the other in these contests. We have no a priori basis for supposing that any one of the diverse and distributed voices that emanate from the landscape speaks with the sort of trumping singular authority that might be thought to issue in so-called normative reasons. The claim is not that none of the competing voices could possibly endowed with singular authority, or that there could not possibly be normative reasons. The point is only that any entitlement to such single normative authority, or to the status of a distinctively normative reason, can be made good only through the messy retail business of settling various contests of reasons. That's the messy retail business. Only the participants in these contests themselves have standing to do so. But so long as each participant is disposed to declare mainly for herself and feels herself entitled to such a one-sided declaration, the contest of reasons will go forever on. Let us close by taking brief stock. I have characterized reason as a distributed power, resident in a diverse array of localized voices, spread over a sprawling, variegated, ever-unfolding landscape. I have suggested that only the landscape in its totality suffices to reveal the true intrinsic nature and destiny of reason. Though I have not begun to chart the landscape in its full complexity, I hope to have said enough to make it clear that once we have done so, we are likely to give the lie to the most cherished dreams of the rationalist. In its temporal unfolding, reason is unlikely to reveal itself as the one sure guide to the true and the good of the rationalist imagining, not even in the fullness of time. In its free and unfettered operation, reason will no doubt sometimes produce wide-ranging normative community, but it is also capable of producing much discord and division. Reason has no doubt enabled us to uncover some of nature's deepest truths, but it has also become mired in error and illusion. I do not deny the majesty and power of the best that reason has bequeathed us, but I insist that the best achievements of reason are hard-won and precarious. They are the uncertain results of messy, bottom-up retail contest in which the victory of neither the true nor the good can be assured in advance. Thank you.